I've invited Bill Colby back on the show this afternoon. Last time I talked to him was sometime last spring in the middle of the Terri Schiavo story. Bill knows a little bit about women in a persistent vegetative state and the fight of their families to end the lives of those women, because he was the lawyer for the family of Nancy Cruzan, who in 1983 went into a persistent vegetative state. And her dad, Joe, signed a consent form for his 25-year-old daughter to have a surgical procedure to insert a feeding tube into her stomach. That about 3 weeks after she'd been in a car wreck. 4 years later, the family made peace with the reality that Nancy would never recover. Joe and the family decided that they would like to have the feeding tube removed. The hospital fought them on that, and it was a fight that actually went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. It was the first time a battle like that had gone all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Bill Colby was the attorney who took it there. Now, after last year's shenanigans in the Terri Schiavo matter, he has written what I think is a terrific primer on the right to die in America. It is called Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America, and I'm proud to have him back here on the Paul Harris Show this afternoon on KMOX. Hi, Bill.
Paul, good to be with you again.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
So let's start with that phrase, right to die. We have a right to die?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It's one of the issues I tackle in the book. I suppose if we said it more accurately, it would be a right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. But as you just said, talking about the bridge, we sometimes shorten and and change words. But we certainly have a right, and you and I, as conscious, competent adults, have a right under the federal Constitution, which Nancy Cruzan's family established for us, to make decisions about our medical treatment, including refusing treatment. But the whole question of how you assert rights starts to get confusing when we can no longer speak like Nancy Cruzan, like Terri Schiavo.
The thing that horrified me in the whole Schiavo matter was politicians sticking their nose in where it didn't belong, into what is truly a private family matter. And it's a horrible decision that a family has to make, but it's a decision that gets made in homes and hospitals and hospices in this country every day, doesn't it?
Well, that certainly is true. If you just take Florida as the example, about 460 people die each day in Florida, most in institutions, most as a result of a decision. And, of course, most of the time, the courts, lawyers, and our statesmen are not involved in that decision-making. It's between medical providers and families doing the best they can. In a case like Schiavo, the courts get involved when families, unfortunately, like the Schiavo family, cannot agree on what decision their loved one might make. And courts certainly have a role in protecting the vulnerable, but Schiavo obviously grew ultimately to become about much more than that. It became a societal debate about what our rules should be and how we live with one another.
Now, you did not have a family dispute in the Nancy Cruzan case, correct?
Not in the Cruzan case, nor in the case that came right after Cruzan from St. Louis, the case of Christine Busalaki. And
right.
In both of those cases, the families were united, and it was the state of Missouri on the other side of the case.
Yeah, I've talked to Pete Busalaki about that case, and he's a man amazingly at peace with everything that he did for his daughter then, and he thinks of it as doing it for his daughter, which I'm sure is what Joe Cruzan thought about his decision for Nancy, right?
Well, and as you and I have talked about before, there but for the grace of God go the rest of us. I've got four kids. I can't imagine being faced with the decisions those families had, or Michael Schiavo, or Mr. and Mrs. Schindler. I find that people like Pete or like the Cruzans tended to watch the Schiavo news coverage and not take sides the way a lot of other people did. They were able to empathize with both the husband and the parents, and maybe the ways the rest of us cannot. People have to. What I've tried to do in the new book and in talking about these issues is to try to put them in some kind of broader context, and the idea being that questions like those in the Schiavo case have come at us in such a rush of technology. The persistent vegetative state was not even named in the medical literature until 1972, because it wasn't until about that time that technology had advanced to the point where we could save someone, in quotes, after an accident or catastrophic illness, and we could bring them back, but not all the way back. And so we started to have these questions about how do we make medical decisions in that case? Brand new questions in our culture. I'm a baby boomer. My parents are the first generation that have ever asked a question, is there something the doctor can provide that I don't want? And they've come at us quickly. They're complicated. The questions change as our medical technology advances, and our ability to talk about them. We're really just starting as a society to talk about these hard questions.
Well, this is the case with so much, not just medical technology, but we're seeing it now with internet technology and privacy, that technology gets out there far ahead of anybody even thinking about what the law is going to do in those cases. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Bill Colby. His book is called Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. Bill, you've worked on a lot of cases, been an attorney for a long time. Was this a particularly hard case for you to work on, the Nancy Cruzan case in the 80s?
Yes and no. In every case, you hope that you can help your client and resolve the dispute that's brought them to the court system. I mean, most of the time we live our lives without getting involved with courts and lawyers, and it's only when the social rules break down that we do. But when it's a case like the Cruzan case, or like the Busalaki case, where you've got people in just such pain and they don't have any good choices, and even in both of those cases, when we ultimately won, what we won was the right of parents to remove a feeding tube from someone they loved and spend days with that loved one as they're dying. It's just those are painful cases, and it's hard to be around. Now, with that said, as a representative, you're several steps removed. I mean, my family, my loved ones were all intact, so it was very different. But I grew close to both families and remain so today.
You talked about how the phrase persistent vegetative state wasn't heard until the early 70s. Would we know the name of the first person who was diagnosed with PVS diagnosed as being in a PVS?
Probably not the first person with such a diagnosis, but we certainly know the first person who brought those words to the general public, and that was in 1976, the New Jersey case of Karen Ann Quinlan. You think about how our education has evolved in these areas. So there have been three major cases that had the question in the national news for an extended period of time. Quinlan in the mid-70s, Cruzan about just before and after 1990, and then Terry Schiavo last year. But each time these cases have gone into the news, we've learned more. With Karen Ann Quinlan, we saw, if you'll probably remember, Paul, the family never showed pictures of her in the hospital. It was her black and white high school yearbook photo with the long straight hair, and that was everywhere at the time. With Nancy Cruzan in 1990, we started to have some idea of what the persistent vegetative state looked like. The PBS program followed the Cruzans around. There was film of Nancy that was on the news. And in the Terry Schiavo case, with the proliferation of cable outlets and news channels everywhere, we saw more. But you think about what a hard question technology has brought to us. And I think sometimes we expect too much, not only from our media, but from the lay public, the idea that we're going to automatically and intuitively understand something as counterintuitive as being unconscious, even though your eyes are open, because one part of your brain is functioning, but the conscious part of your brain is not functioning. It's complicated. And we're working through it as a society, and the questions, we will continue to work through them. They're not getting easier, nor are they getting or are they coming at us less frequently?
I think that was one of the major points that people came to in the Schiavo matter was what exactly does it mean to be in a persistent vegetative state? Because we remember that video of her with, you know, it's seemingly her eyes moving, her mom talking to her, to people who weren't actually there in the room and only saw that video. It looked like she might be responding to her mom. You know, Dr. Bill Frist, who's the Senate Majority Leader, was, as far as I'm concerned, completely out of line and actually diagnosing her as not being in a PVS just based on seeing that video. Is there consensus in the medical community about a persistent vegetative state?
I think there is. I think there's consensus on the diagnosis and how the diagnosis is made. That doesn't mean there aren't mistakes when people make that diagnosis, that people haven't been diagnosed as being vegetative when, in fact, they were slightly outside of a vegetative state. But in different medical groups' guidelines, like the American Academy of Neurology, for example, there is consensus about how you make the diagnosis. It's a clinical diagnosis made at the bedside. After continued observation, it can be confirmed by various laboratory studies like a CT scan, but it's a clinical diagnosis, and part of the diagnosis is that there is prolonged lack of conscious interaction through the various ways that we test for that interaction. But again, you're exactly right. When the very first time I walked into Nancy Cruzan's hospital room in 1987, I certainly had no concept of what permanent unconsciousness was, what eyes open unconsciousness was, and I've seen many patients over the years, and I've learned more about it, and I understand how you can have such a counterintuitive diagnosis, but I also understand how when people saw the video of Terry Schiavo, you would have a visceral reaction which would say, boy, that doesn't look like what unconsciousness is to me. And I think that's part of our, we learn as we go, we have this education. And I had the sense in the Schiavo case, I've always believed in the axiom that the cure to bad speech is more speech, not censorship. And my guess is you as a radio show host would, that's probably how you would approach life too. And I think all of the speech around the Schiavo case, even when it was factually not exactly accurate, I think it helped move the public discussion forward because for an extended period of time, we were talking about a topic that as a culture we don't easily talk about, and I think that's good. I know that millions of people over the last 18 months have had a conversation which in some way started to say, were I in Terry Schiavo's shoes, this is what I would want. And I think that's a worthwhile conversation, whatever your views are and whatever exactly you thought Terry Schiavo's shoes might be.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm a huge First Amendment advocate because it's how I've been making my living for over 28 years. The only problem I have with speech is when ignorant speech is turned into law and it gets in the way of decisions that it shouldn't get in the way of. Bill Colby's new book is called Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. We'll have more in a moment as the Paul Harris Show continues here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Bill Colby. He's got a new book out called Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. Bill was the attorney who helped out the family of Nancy Cruzan and the family of Christine Busolaki in their efforts against the politicians in the state of Missouri who did not want the families to remove the machinery that was keeping them alive after several years in a persistent vegetative state. And we were just talking before the break about what a PVS is. And, Bill, you've mentioned a couple of times how medical technology has improved here. You write in the book about something called a PEG tube. Can you give us a brief description of what that is and how that may have changed things?
Oh, it's a great question. The PEG tube, which a lot of people in the medical world know about, PEG is an acronym for percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy. But it deals with the way the tube is put in. In about 1980, two doctors in Cleveland at a children's hospital concerned with the kind of feeding tube surgery that Nancy Cruz Ann had, which is a full surgical insertion directly into the stomach under complete anesthesia, came up with the idea of an endoscopic insertion of a feeding tube. The whole idea of a doctor called an endoscopist was brand new in 1980, and this procedure was basically like threading a string through your gym shorts, where you made a small hole in the stomach from the outside, then threaded the endoscope down through the mouth, put a string in that hole, pulled it out, tied the feeding tube outside your mouth to the string, and then pulled it back through, and you had a fully functioning feeding tube, much less invasive, much less trauma. But part of what happened, and again, the point we were talking about how the ethics struggles to keep up with the technology, during Cruz Ann in the 80s and at the Supreme Court in 1990, we were talking about full gastrostomy feeding tubes, a tube implanted through surgery, basically done only after accident or critical injury when someone had a chance to recover. But while we were having that debate, the technology moved forward. Feeding tubes became easier to put in. They started to be put in for a lot of people as a matter of course. And now there are about 300,000 PEG tubes placed each year, most in an elderly population. And we're just starting to have the debate about, yes, we can do this, but is this a technology that we want to use? And that's not just in the medical world. It's you and I, too, talking with our kids or with our parents about what it is you want out of life, what it is you want out of medical treatment, and how do you decide? And man, these are hard questions, and not questions that we, you know, on Sunday afternoon we're watching football. We're not talking about these topics, but As we baby boomers age, the questions will be coming more and more.
And quality of life is always an important part of that decision. I went through that with my dad, who died a slow, horrible death over the course of several years. And when I saw his quality of life deteriorating, I've told this story on the air many times about how my brother and my mom and I, we had read Final Exit and, read about the Hemlock Society and other things, and we would have been willing to help him make the decision, well, not make the decision, but we would have been willing to help him carry out whatever his decision was while he was still lucid enough to do it, if he had decided to do it. And that is a decision that many families do have to face on a regular basis.
Well, and I think it's incumbent on us to think about, and with the whole idea that we hear talked about today of living wills and powers of attorney for health care and making your wishes known. A lot of people talk about that area, saying, what I really want, I want to have this written down so people know what it is I want. But to me, what's far more important than making what it is you know that you want known when you can no longer speak, what I want to do is provide for the people I will have left behind, my loved ones, my family, my kids, some idea of what my views and values are so that they won't be faced with conflict and indecision about what to do. It's not so my wishes will be carried out, but it's so that they'll be able to make what will be really hard decisions, so they'll have the best information they can to make those, and the least amount of guilt and the greatest amount of confidence. They'll still be hard, but I think that's a gift we give to our loved ones, and you're exactly right. I mean, they are coming to us more and more, and we need to have these talks. It's amazing to me, but I spend my time now talking to groups around the country about these topics. I find the best way for people to think about the questions are stories like yours with your father, or certainly the story of Terry Schiavo. We learn through sharing stories, and so I think the more we can tell stories about when medical treatment went well at the end of life, when it did not go well, and talk about what our reaction are to those stories, I think that's a real gift to our families.
Now, you talk about the paperwork and all of that, and talking to your family so that your wishes are known. That is what Michael Schiavo says Terry Schiavo did with him while they were together, so that he says he was acting upon what her wishes were Unfortunately, she had never expressed that to her parents, or if she did, there was some confusion about that, and that is why we had that giant battle, not just last year, but it had gone on for a couple of years before that. Is there a way, Bill, and I'm asking you this as an attorney, William Colby, is there a way for a person to get some paperwork done that absolutely makes it clear? I know we talk about living wills and medical powers of attorney. Is there a way for us to do that so that it's absolutely clear? So if somebody does find themselves in a persistent vegetative state, the people around them don't have to go through any of these hoops, don't have to jump through those hoops to get done what I want done, were that to be me.
When you talk with people who deal with the seriously ill, they all start nodding their heads. Where whatever part of the country you're in, when you start talking about a situation like the Schiavo family, not certainly in the public eye the way the Schiavos and Schindlers were, but you start to say, we've got one family member who says the person wanted one thing, other family members fly in from out of town, they didn't get along that well before this crisis, and now all of the family dysfunction is coming forward, and the piece of paper, whatever it might be at that point, is just a little less useful. So here's the advice I give people on this topic. It's certainly not foolproof, but it's the best way I know to help your loved ones avoid the kind of incredible strife we saw in the Schiavo case. First, I think you do need to fill out a legal document, a piece of paper. I don't have the living will, which says if I, Bill Colby, am in a coma, I do or do not want a respirator. I've got the much simpler document, which is the power of attorney for healthcare, where it simply says, this is the person I named to make my decisions. Here's my first alternate. Here's my second alternate.
And that cannot be challenged by anybody else in the family?
Well, let me just go on and get to
All right.
Steps. Because that in Florida, the law, they have a state law which says, we decide the order of decision makers, and the spouse is the first decision maker. So Michael Schiavo, by law, was the first decision maker, just the same way if I name my wife, which I do in my document, she's the first decision maker. So you've got that. But then I think you need to take the second step, and that is to talk to that person about what your views and values are, about Terry Schiavo, about these conversations, everyone I've been involved in. Once you start, it leads to a second story of some kind. So you talk about stories so that person knows, but then you've got to take the third critical step, what did not happen in the Schiavo case, and that is talk with everyone who will be in the room that you can figure out when those decisions are made for you about your conversation and about your views and values. And you especially need to reach out to that person in your family who is hardest to talk with. What did not happen in Schiavo was, and what didn't get reported much in the news, and I thought would have been extremely useful, prior to her 1990 cardiac arrest, for the first 4 years of Terry and Michael Schiavo's marriage, there were periods of time where Terry and Michael Schiavo lived in the basement of Bob and Mary Schindler's house, where they took meals together, where they vacationed together. What if just once during that time she had sat those three people down, her two parents and her husband, and talked about Nancy Kruzan or Karen Quinlan? Would that conversation have avoided all that we saw happen? We don't know. But I think those three steps, filling out the piece of paper, talking to the person you've given the power to about your views, and then talking with the extended group that will be in the room, I think that's about as good a way as any. And then you revisit that topic as the years go on and your views and values change. You make copies of those documents so that it's not hidden away somewhere, so people know what it says. And my guess is most of the time it will work. It'll still be hard, but it will work.
We'll include your phone calls when we come back in another segment here with Bill Colby. His book is a terrific one. It's called Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. And this is News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with attorney Bill Colby about his new book, Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. And when you use that word reclaiming in the title, it sounds like the right has been taken away. Although when John Ashcroft was Attorney General, he tried to deny the voters of Oregon the right to have a Death with Dignity Act, which was approved by those voters twice. Were you thinking of stories like that when you wrote the book, Bill?
Well, I certainly have a chapter on the Oregon experience, and I think it's that's an interesting social experiment and important for people to understand what's going on there. Oregon is the only state, as you know, that allows by law physician-assisted suicide. I think what's more important in Oregon than the more important than actually the physician-assisted suicide, they've had that law for 8 years now. It's been used. They have to report each year. They've reported 208 deaths under the act. But during that same time, over 210,000 people in Oregon died. So less than 0.1% of all deaths in the state have been as a result of the law. It really, in many ways, has not been an issue. And they found that when people get to the end of life, even when it's compromised, we're human. We still cling to life. What I think is more interesting in Oregon is that as a result of the two initiative campaigns you mentioned, they have in that state talked about death and dying more than the rest of us, by far. So as their former governor said, we talked about it on golf courses and in barber shops and at bridge clubs and everywhere else, and once that was out of the toothpaste tube, you couldn't put it back in. And so as a result, in Oregon, they have higher hospice utilization. They have better scoring on people's satisfaction with their care in a hospital. They have greater deaths in home, and they just do dying better. I'm not sure having a public debate over those questions is the way to get to that end, but it is interesting that that's a side effect. And I think the coaching point for the rest of us is mortality affects all of us, and so the talk is something worthwhile to do.
I know you work with hospices quite a bit. I have a sister-in-law who's worked with people in hospices as well. I have nothing but praise for the people who do that work with people whose life is coming to its end. That's an absolutely tender time, and the people who do it do great work. As you go around and you speak on their behalf and on the behalf of the right to die, do you have people who have severe objections to the things that you say?
Oh, you know, I try to approach the topic in as even-handed a way as possible and without judgment, because I've got no judgment. I think the lessons that I see coming out of a case like Terry Schiavo's apply at whether you're in the great unwashed middle or you're at one of the far ends of the spectrum, whichever end that might be on. I think you benefit the people you love by talking about what your wishes and what your views and values are, and there's I think you approach people with respect. I think you talk about these issues openly, and there are people of goodwill and strong belief who differ on how the question should come out. That's part of how a democracy works. But the solution is to keep talking, and I think and not judging one another.
Well, once again, you have moved the discussion forward with the book, Unplugged, Reclaiming Our Right to Die in America. Congratulations on that, and thanks for your time today, as always.
Paul, I appreciate that. And just before I go, let me say one last thing. A place with that National Hospice Group where people can find these free documents online is caringinfo.org, caringinfo.org. It's a good website.
I will put a link to it along with the link to your book on my website, harrisonline.com. Thank you, Bill.
Enjoyed it as always, Paul.
Bill Colby here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.